Welcome back, murder friends, to
Under the Influence of True Crime. That's Kate, and she's telling our story.
And that's Em, and they're under the influence.
I'm working on it.
And this week, we're bringing you a mystery.
Bum bum.
It's to kick off Spooktober.
Spooktober. This is like one of our favorite cases. We're going to be bringing you spooky, ooky shit all fucking month long. I've got a super special one for like Halloween.
Yes.
So many spooky shits coming your way.
We're really excited. Spooktober is kind of our jam. Fall is our jam. So to kick it off, I am actually going with one of the cases that got me invested in true crime. I originally heard it on Morbid on a 10-hour drive to Kentucky to see my family. And I remember calling M and being like, my brain is exploding right now. Like, this case set me on edge. It made my heart ache, and then it made me furious.
I concur.
Yeah. And I have some new information for you that you definitely don't know that's only going to break your freaking heart further.
Oh, Lord.
Yes, I discovered it today. It is 2021 knowledge, so.
Oh, shit. Yeah, I definitely don't know then. I haven't heard anything about this case.
Before. Yeah. So anyway, I will be talking today about the disappearance of the Sodder children.
Bum, bum, bum.
Yes.
We just wanted to like quick interjection. We're not talking about the Gabby Petito case for any specific reason or anything. We're just not putting information out that hasn't been confirmed. There's a lot of suspicion going around.
We're waiting to hear some more stuff and we're waiting to hear some more confirmed stuff.
Right. Once there's more confirmed information, we will update you guys. In the meantime, have been like, I know I specifically have been doing this and I encourage everyone else to just look up like and look into other missing persons cases.
The nation, you know, embraced the Gabby Petito case that we're, you know, getting information quickly. Like that's fantastic, but that's how it should be for every missing persons case.
Right. That's what I'm trying to
say. Yeah.
So I would just say, look at missing people cases that is in your area so that you can help keep an eye out because everyone deserves to have this kind of coverage and not
put that same energy into it.
Exactly. Anyway, so that's all that we're going to say for now.
I will actually say one other thing. I heard a rumor that Dog the Bounty Hunter is now on the case looking for.
He is. And the.
Listen, my hope went up. Okay. Wait, they what?
He was like at the laundry house knocking on the door and they wouldn't let him in and they called the cop.
Ooh, Dog the Bounty Hunter. Could you imagine how awesome that would be to like be a police officer and you like get to the house and you're like, are you Dog the Bounty Hunter?
Right.
Okay, so for the trigger warning this week, it is going to be about some whack ass shit. Very frustrating, but no confirmed deaths. We're really putting the spook.
You're just going to walk away feeling pissed.
Truly, you're going to be mad. You're going to be mad that I even brought this to the table.
Honestly.
That being said, it's thrilling. So buckle up, babies.
Buckle up.
So I'm going to set the scene for you all. It's Christmas Eve, 1945, in Fayetteville, West Virginia. George and Jenny have a large family in their home with 10 children. However, it is important to note to our story that the eldest Sodder child, a unnamed boy, was away in the military at the time of the incident.
God, that we never learned what his name was.
Well, I'm pretty sure, because I did some digging, and I'm fairly certain it's actually the second eldest son, and his name's Joe.
Interesting. Okay.
Because John is 23 at the time of the incident, and that math adds up for me for him being the eldest. So I think it was John, Joseph, and then George Jr.
If anyone hears banging around, I'm making cookies while we're recording.
Yeah. M's a nightmare, but this isn't new.
Nope.
And normally we wouldn't do this so haphazard, but Kate, work soon. So this do be
and
how
I
we
just,
are.
And then I'm making cookies. So
I support the energy.
Do.
To give some background to who this family is, I'm going to talk about George and Jenny for a second. George was born Giorgio Sodu in Sardinia, Italy in 1895.
What was the last name?
Sodu.
I love that. That's so cute.
Yeah. When Giorgio turned 13, he and his older brother immigrated to Ellis Island in America. However, as soon as they both cleared customs, the brother went back on the boat and he went home to Italy. It seems like he was just dropping George off. And he was like, all right, peace, you're here. I did my deal. See you later. For the rest of his life, George Sauter, as he would change his name to be, would not talk about why he left Italy. So that's kind of fun. Kind of fun, interesting.
I'm just getting off the boat, just be like, bye. I'm out of here.
Yeah. Well, he did. He literally like dropped him off and was like, peace out.
Bye.
So like I said, he wouldn't talk about why he left Italy, but he was really outspoken throughout his life about being anti-fascist and against Mussolini, which is a really important note for later in this story.
Yeah, hold on to that.
Yeah, just like keep that in the little clutches. George originally worked on the railroads of Pennsylvania to try and make a living, but he did soon find himself in West Virginia, first doing driving and then actually starting his own trucking company. While in West Virginia, he met the daughter of a local Italian store owner, Jenny Cipriani, who had immigrated from Italy as a young child.
Cute.
Yeah, we love it. A young love. They quickly got married and moved just outside Fayetteville, which was known for their large Italian immigrant community. They moved into a two-story home just outside of Fayetteville, and in 1923, they had the first of their 10 children.
10?
Yeah, you heard that right.
10?
I already said 10.
Jesus.
Wait till I list them all. You're going to be like, why does it keep going?
Yeah, because it's like 4 and then 5 and then the 1. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. You're with it. George's business was growing every day, and the family quickly established themselves as a really respected middle-class family in the area. However, like I said earlier, George had strong opinions about a lot of things, and he was not shy about expressing them to everybody.
But also, he came from there. He's allowed to have those opinions and share them because he was actually there.
That's the thing, though. So is the community. The whole community is made up of Italian immigrants, and so a lot of people are divided on it. Some of them, they all came to America to try and make a better life for themselves, but some of them disagree about, whether leaving Italy was the best thing or not. Some people really put their whole roots in America and they were like, I'm not with it back there. A lot of shit was going on. And some of them were like, that's the motherland. You're disrespecting it. You're just being a piece of shit. So he was saying it to the wrong people. So he'd often alienate people away from him because of his strong opinions.
Same.
I will say though, all of the opinions that were being expressed were simply maybe we shouldn't treat people like shit and maybe we shouldn't murder Italians, stuff like that.
I appreciate the kisses. You want to say hi?
That was Joe. My main man, Joe. That was the tiny microphone from TikTok.
Well, here, Joe, do you want to say some more? Should we go get your brother? Birdman, do you have anything to say?
Speak now.
Thank you for your input.
Silent but deadly. In particular, George had firm opposition to Italian dictator Benito Mussolini, and this led to some strong arguments with other members of the Italian immigrant community. So a lot of the people thought that Mussolini was doing some good shit, despite the fact that he was executing a ton of Italian people while declaring it in the name of Italian freedom. So that's where a lot of this contention comes from. And George wasn't making bad points. He was just, being kind of aggressive about it.
Right.
So I do want to list you the billion children that they had. It is going to start with John, Joe, Marion, George Jr., Maurice, Martha, Louis, Jenny, Betty, and we're going to end with Sylvia. Sylvia was the last child, and she was born in 1943. So this is just 2 years before our Christmas Eve incident. So originally, like I said earlier, I had heard it was the eldest son that was away serving in the military, but some sources said it was the second eldest son, Joe, who was serving in World War II when Sylvia was born. And that math adds up because John confirms he was there. So I'm with it. You're with it. We're good. My man, Joe. The next year, Mussolini would be removed from power and executed, and this was fine with George, who vehemently opposed fascism and openly criticized Mussolini, but it left a sour taste in the mouths of many who did agree with Mussolini, and they did not appreciate George's opinions or celebrations after.
I don't think I realized, how this wasn't that far in the past.
1945?
For some reason, I was thinking, way early 1900s.
No. George was born in 1895.
Interesting.
Yeah, isn't that weird? He died in the 60s.
Like, when I think of this story, it's happening, like...
I understand. Yeah. But, like, people alive right now used to drive past the billboard in Fayetteville. Like, they knew about this billboard. It wasn't taken down until 1989. In October of 1945, and this is the year, so we're in the year. So these are important notes that happened just months before December. So in October of 1945, a life insurance salesman got mad after George wouldn't buy from him, threatening that his house would, quote, go up in smoke and your children are going to be destroyed, explaining it was because of, quote, all the dirty remarks you've been making about Mussolini.
What a weird thing to say someone who's not buying something from you.
Yeah, you're like, you're not going to buy that shit from me? Well, fuck you and your house.
Burn your house down. I'm going to kidnap your children. Fuck you.
Mussolini. Anyway. That feels so weirdly specific to be like coincidental, right? Right.
Right. Like, no, that's not. Yeah, that's.
Just a little bit later that year, another visitor at the house who was looking for work went around back and told George his pair of fuse boxes would cause a fire someday, which George found particularly odd because he had just had the house rewired because they got an electric stove installed and the local electric company declared it safe afterwards.
But, like, I don't think that's so much, like, a red flag to me because, like, anyone who knows anything about electricity could, like, look at it and be like, oh, that's a fire hazard, just so you know. You
know? Well, what was weird to George was that, like I said, he had just been cleared by because it was recently done. And also, it was seemed like the guy was just, like, trying to get work. And some people who, like, are looking at this later think it might have been, like, pre-sabotage. Like, he was trying to make it seem like an electrical fire.
Okay, yep.
So anyway, those are just like some suspicions that have come out to light. The elder Sauter sons also noted for a few weeks before Christmas that there was a strange car parked on the main highway that they had running through Fayetteville and that people inside seemed to be watching the younger Sauter children while they came home from school. So this catches us up to all the weird funny business before the actual incident of note on Christmas Eve. The Sauter children had began celebrating that day because their sister, Marion, had been working at a local store and she brought toys home for them for Christmas.
Can you remind me of the year one more time? 45?
December 24th, Christmas Eve, 1945.
I was right. Thank you.
Yeah. All of the children were so excited that they asked if they could stay up past their bedtime to play a little bit longer. It was about 10 p.m. at this point. Their mom, seeing Miriam with them, said yeah, but reminded Louis and Maurice to feed the chickens and put the cows up before everyone went to bed. Everybody agreed, and Jenny scooped up baby Sylvia, who was about 2, and went upstairs, not knowing that it was the last time she would see 5 of her children again.
That's a big oof right there.
So Jenny woke up at 12:30 to the sound of the telephone ringing. She went into her husband's office and answered it, but a woman on the other line asked for someone she did not know. And Jenny said the only thing of note was that the woman had a really weird laugh. I was like, damn, that's kind of savage, but I...
A weird laugh? What time did this, like, because...
12:30.
They have to stay up at... that's what I thought. I thought it was fucking late. Okay.
So it's 12:30 at this point, a.m. So Jenny hung up after saying it was a weird or a wrong number, and she went back to bed, but then she noticed that the lights were still on and the curtains were still open, which something that her kids would normally have taken care of if they would have been up later than the adults. She saw Marion was already asleep on the couch, so she assumed the other children had already gone to bed upstairs. She closed the blinds and turned off the lights and went back upstairs to bed. At 1 a.m., Jenny woke up again as there was a loud thud on the roof. She listened to see if it was going to happen again, but when it didn't, she went back to sleep. However, just a half hour later, she woke up for the third and final time that night, smelling smoke, and she quickly got up and went into her husband's office, and she found that the whole thing was, like, covered in fire and surrounding the phone.
Oof.
She ran to get, you know, her kids. She started screaming for George and the others to, like, wake up and, like, let people know. Marion quickly grabbed Sylvia, and she, Sylvia, John, and George Jr. made it out of the house along with her parents as they shouted for the other kids to get out. In his original testimony, John... said he went upstairs and, like, physically tried to, like, wake up his siblings and then ran back downstairs. But in, like, an updated one later, he said he just yelled for them up the stairs and that he never, like, physically saw them. So that's just kind of, like, an interesting thing that, you know, I don't know, kind of weird. Put a pin in that. They're getting out and George looks back up and sees that the stairway is filled with fire, so he couldn't get back inside to grab the children, but he was not going to stop at that point. His plan was to bypass the downstairs completely by going through the upstairs window to get into the attic to like get those kids. The phone wasn't working, so Marion ran to her neighbors next door to call the fire department, but the neighbor couldn't get connected to the operator. Another neighbor who happened to be driving by drove straight to the chief, and the chief was too drunk, so he said he would have to wait until someone who could drive the truck was there.
That was the most 1945 thing ever. I'm too drunk to drive the fire truck. Give me a minute.
Well, it ended up taking him 8 hours because the fire department did not show up for 8 hours. They got there at 9 a.m., 8 or 9 a.m. It was only 2 miles away, by the way.
That fire department's fucking paid off.
So, you know, that's interesting. But by the time the fire department obviously like showed up, the house was gone, you know, it was burned down. Sorry, the house took a little more than half an hour to burn completely to the ground. But before we were there, while Marion was at the neighbor's house, George was busy scaling the wall to get to the attic window. And he tried to bust through the window and he cut his arm, like trying to get in. So normally George would have used the ladder that was propped up against the side of the house, but that was missing. It had been there earlier in the day. It was gone then. So it would be found later, but we're going to talk about that. With him scaling the wall and that not working, he turned to his two work trucks. He thought he could move next to the house to try to climb onto and then climb up. But weirdly, when he went to move them, the two trucks that had worked perfectly the day before wouldn't start now.
Yeah.
Next, he tried to scoop water to quell the fire, but it was frozen solid.
Yeah, because it was December.
So for the next 45 minutes, the six sodders who had managed to get out watched in agony and frustration as their house burnt to the ground. And as far as they knew, their five children were still inside.
Yeah.
Naturally, they assumed that the other five kids had all passed away in the fire. When the fire department finally arrived, and this fucked me up, apparently one of them was actually Jenny's brother.
What the fuck?
Yeah, one of the fire department. Like, I was like, what? Like, what? They basically
saw your sister's address pop up as there's a fire here. And not only did you not go immediately, you waited 8 hours.
Yeah. Yeah. What was that? So they basically couldn't do anything but look through the ash and remains of the house that had been left in the solder's basement. And by 10 a.m., Chief Morris said he had found no bones, which suggested the fire had simply been hot enough to have reduced them all to ash.
No. That's physically impossible.
In case anyone listening is curious, this is not true because when a body is cremated, it takes upwards of 2 to 3 hours for bodies and bones to be fully reduced to ash.
And the average heat index of like a house fire.
We are going to talk about that. Yeah. Not like the average heat for like the house fire, but a like cremator, that's wrong. But like at a cremation place to get your bones cremated, theirs runs 2,000 Fahrenheit. In case
2,000 degrees.
Yeah. In case you guys were wondering, house fires do not get that hot.
A house fire burns about 1,000 degrees.
Yeah. And the house was at the ground by like 45 minutes. Okay.
So 45 minutes at 1,000 degrees isn't going to do anything.
It's not going to get rid of the bones.
And when a body gets cremated at 2,000 degrees for 3 to 4 hours, there were still bone fragments left.
Truly, yeah, they don't get all of it.
No.
So Morris told the Sodders to leave the scene of the crime alone, but due to their immense grief, Jenny and George couldn't bear to look at it, so they bulldozed it with intent to create a memorial garden for their children, which I get, but like, honestly, looking back, there wasn't going to be anything done anyway, so.
No, because the kids weren't fucking in there.
No, like, so. The following day, the local coroner made an inquest, which said that the fire was an accident caused by faulty wiring. And in the jury pool was the man who threatened George his house would be burned down and his kids destroyed for his anti-Mussolini shit.
Is that not a conflict of interest?
It should be, but it's 1945 and that doesn't exist.
I guess.
The death certificates for the five Sodder children were issued on December 30th, just 5 short days after the fire. A local newspaper originally claimed that all of the bodies of the children were found, but ironically, in the same article later down, it reported only one body recovered, despite the fact that there were no bodies discovered.
There was not a single body discovered.
The family held a funeral on January 2nd, 1946.
Stop. I just got a fucking tweet notification. They fucking identified the Zodiac Killer.
What?
I just got a tweet notification. Zodiac Killer identified as Gary Francis, who died in 2018. I'm so sorry to interrupt. I just got this notification.
I'm sorry. What? This is ironic because somebody today literally posted about how they're convinced that their grandfather is the Zodiac Killer.
Francis Post.
We're going to look back into that and we're going to come back to that.
Sorry to interrupt. Oh my gosh.
Okay, so the family held a funeral on January 2nd in 1946, but George and Jenny were still too grief-stricken to attend. The other Sodder children were actually in attendance, though. Quickly, the Sodders began questioning all of the official findings because the more time went on, the less the answers actually made sense. One example came from George about how the fire couldn't have been electrical in nature or faulty wiring because the Christmas lights were still working at the beginning of the fire. And that's something like other people note too, is that at the early stages, the Christmas lights were still on. This is also around the time that George discovered his ladder that should have been leaned against the side of the house in an embankment 75 or so feet away from his house. Like, that's pretty weird.
Like, someone just, like,
right? Like, they were like,
on this ladder in particular.
This bitch empty. As well, when they had a phone repairman over, he said the lines had not been burned in the fire. They had been cut by someone who had climbed 14 feet in the air to do it.
Such as with a ladder and a work truck?
Maybe. Neighbors did admit to seeing a man stealing a block and tackle from the property. This was around the time of the fire, and he was found and promptly arrested. Now, if you're like me, you're going, what the heck is a block and tackle? Because I didn't know. Unless you do know.
No.
Cool. So a block and tackle is apparently a device that is a pulley system used for lifting heavy shit. It's one of those things where they mount the pulley to the they mount the pulley to the ceiling, yeah. And then it's got the second one right there, and then they do the box thing. It's that one.
Yeah.
This man admitted to the theft, and he claimed he had cut the phone line thinking it was the power line, but really this just leaves the question of why he would feel the need to cut the power line to their house when he was stealing something from the yard.
Right. Like, either way, that doesn't make any fucking sense.
Like, what, you just did that for fun?
Either way, why were you cutting wires?
Yeah, he said he was not involved at all with the fire, and no record of who this man was exists today.
I just tried to cut their power lines, is y'all.
Right? And there's, like, no record of who he is, and his motives make no fucking sense. In 1968, Jenny did say that if the man had been successful in cutting the power line, that she and her family would never have been able to make it out of the house. And I was like, that's interesting. And I kind of was like, what do you mean by that? But okay. So Jenny also called bullshit on Morris's theories that the bodies had been reduced to ash, especially since appliances of theirs were still recognizable, and so were pieces of their tin roof. She also began looking into other house fires and, like, records, comparing them to her family's. One fire was around the same time and killed a family of 7, and there were skeletal remains found for all of them. And so she was like, that's pretty sus.
Tin melts at 450 degrees Fahrenheit.
That's interesting.
So if it wasn't hot enough to melt a tin roof.
It wasn't hot enough to melt pieces of the tin roof.
Right, but that's what I'm saying. Like,
that's true.
It's not hot enough to fully melt a tin roof that has a melting point of 450 degrees.
Then where are the bones? Noodle, where are they? Noodle?
I love him so much. Noodle, I would die.
Only astrology I trust.
That was funny.
There were no bones yesterday, and I had a terrible day. Tell me that's not science. Okay.
Did we see if there were bones?
There were no bones today.
Okay.
But there are pictures of Noodle in a raincoat, so you got to take and give.
Thank God.
You know, I mean, because he didn't post the no bone video, but he commented on the raincoat video. Also, for those wondering, no bones for Noodle today.
I understand.
The man understands what his audience wants. Thank you, Noodle.
Truly.
Oh, this is so funny. So Jenny's whack. Listen to this shit. So Jenny starts burning the bones of small animals to see if she could reduce them to ash, and she was unsuccessful every time.
Because bones don't do that. Bones,
Jenny,
don't work,
you're
that.
A baller. Jenny was like,
I fucking love Jenny.
She was like, no.
Jenny, I would love to be her friend.
Dude, Jenny's whack. So she called the local crematorium, and he informed her that they burned bodies at 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit, and in 2 hours, the bones would still be there, and that it was much hotter and longer than a house fire could ever burn. That's a quote.
And even if a house fire, for some reason, was 2,000 to 3,000 degrees,
it only burned for 45 minutes. That's so, true. Like, some people claim that it, like, burned all night, but, like, nah.
No, it, like, smoldered all night, I'm sure.
Yeah, I was like, there were some ashy chunks for sure. Whatever. Anyway, the Sodders also began to believe their trucks had been tampered with, potentially by the same dude who stole the block and tackle. In 2013, though, one of the Sodder son-in-laws, I believe it was, his last name's Paxton, which would be Sylvia's husband. He did say he suspected the potential that in their haste and desperation that they might have flooded the engine. However, I feel like George was someone who would know, like he would know what that sounded like, desperation or not.
Right.
Like, I just feel like even if, like, you know, the blood's in his ears, he's panicking, he's not just going to sit there and hold it to flood the, like, anyway. No. Maybe I'm an asshole. Maybe you're right, Mr. Paxton. Unclear.
No, like, you wouldn't just sit there and hold it. Regardless, I don't. Like, I mean, obviously, I wasn't in that situation. But, like, you know if it's not starting or not.
As someone who has flooded the engine before, it was before I knew how to drive. But I'm a dummy, so anyway.
But also, like, you're not someone who's, like, driving these work trucks every day.
I'm not experienced, but, like, that's the thing. Like, George had been around forever. Like, he did have experience in things like this. And I just have faith in my man, George. Anyway.
Me too.
Thank you. Although it was suggested that the call to the wrong number was potentially, like, you know, like a thing, they did find her and she admitted it really was just a misdial on her part. That spring, the Sodders created their memorial garden for their children over the remains of the house, and Jenny tended it lovingly for the remainder of her life until 1989. However, that same year as the garden, 1946, information began suggesting the fire was not actually accidental at all. A bus driver.
Wow, I'm shocked. Oh no, this is brand new information.
A bus driver that had been passing through Fayetteville late that eve saw some people throwing balls of fire at the Sodder home.
Did you just say late that eve?
I did, because it was Christmas Eve. Do you get it? Thank you.
I love that. That was good.
He said he saw people throwing balls of fire at the Sodder house. So, like, that's interesting. Once the snow melted a few months later, Sylvia, the little two-year-old, well, I guess she'd be three at this point, she found a small dark green rubber ball-like object in a bush nearby. And George remembered the loud thud that Jenny had heard that night. And he said the device looked like a pineapple hand bomb grenade or some other, like, incendiary device. And for, like, the rest of their lives, the family fully believed against the fire department's conclusion that the fire had originated on the tin roof.
Yeah.
But by that point, you know, it had been bulldozed. There was no way to determine that, so.
Well, and also the fire department and the police obviously don't.
Yeah, I was like, there wasn't going to be anything determined anyway. That's right. Why I hate when people get mad about him having, like, bulldozed over it. I was like, y'all can say all you want, but, like, they were not going to do it.
They weren't going to fucking do anything, no.
This is around the time that reports started coming in from people about the missing children, that they were seeing them, and not, like, as ghosts. One of the people who had been watching the fire claimed she actually saw the Sodder children peering out of the window of a passing car while the house was burning. A woman at a rest stop between Fayetteville and Charleston said she served them breakfast on Christmas morning, and she saw a car with Florida plates in the parking lot. Naturally, the Sodders were like, oh yeah, what the fuck? And they hired a PI named CC Tinsley to look into the case and the reported sightings.
CC Tinsley! I fucking love CC Tinsley! Hell yeah!
He did come into play.
Alrighty, all right.
So CC Tinsley is the man who discovered that one of the jurors had actually been the spurned insurance salesman. He brought this back to George and he was like, hey yo, the fuck? He also conveyed to the Sodders that even though no remains had been found in the ashes, that apparently Morris had found a heart and secretly packed and buried it. Yeah, later this turned out to be a beef liver, and when asked, he said he just thought he could do it so he could give the Sodders some closure for their dead children.
So explain this to me.
Yeah.
The bones and everything burnt to a crisp, to an ash.
Not a single heart.
Unrecognizable, but a heart is in full, perfect condition, just laying in the ground.
Yeah, so George and Tinsley actually made Morris dig it up, and the local funeral director confirmed it wasn't even exposed to the fire, and it was not even a heart, simply a beef liver. My man couldn't even go fully and commit to buying a heart.
Get on the fucking black market, man.
Well, I mean, like, if you can buy a cow heart, like, that's not that hard.
Right. No, I just, like, picture this man going to the grocery store.
Excuse me, do you guys carry hearts here? I have to get your family, their children are really dead.
And then just like carrying it. And just be like, yeah, this.
He this put it in a metal box and buried it because that was less weird, apparently. Yep.
How did it get in the box if it was, whatever.
I don't work here. So George was not satisfied to just wait for the reports of his missing children to come in. At one point, he saw a ballerina in the news that looked like his daughter, Betty. So he drove all the way to New York City to see the girl, and he was repeatedly refused at her school. So he never got to. George also repeatedly requested the intervention of the FBI, but they were not legally able to come help until the Fayetteville PD reached out, and they refused to do so.
It should not be the fucking victim's family's job to fucking find them.
True. The Sodders did not stop here, despite the fact that officials were closing their case and removed their help. They printed flyers with pictures of the children and a $5,000 reward that they would quickly double for any information about even just one of the kids. The famous Sodder Children billboard went up in 1952 at the site of the house and another along Route 60 with the same information, and it was a landmark in Fayetteville on Route 19 until it was removed. These efforts did bring another round of reported sightings. One woman who ran a Charleston hotel said she saw the kids about a week afterwards, saying they were with two men and two women, and they all looked Italian.
What, like, a bold move, like, steal these children and then take them out in public?
Right? They're like, hey. She said she tried to speak to the kids, and one of the men turned really hostile and started speaking Italian, and suddenly no one in the party would talk to her, and they left early the next morning. But police don't consider her story credible because she didn't see the photos of the kids until 2 years after the fire, and she came forward 5 years later. George always handled the leads in person, driving across the country to get to where the sightings were. He drove to St. Louis, Missouri, because a woman claimed Martha was in a convent there. And a bar patron in Texas claimed he overheard incriminating conversations about a Christmas fire in West Virginia. None of these ended up being significant by any means. One time, George even learned that one of Jenny's relatives in Florida had children that looked like his. Like, yeah, man, they're related to your wife. So that math adds up. But he wouldn't leave them alone until they proved the children were not George's.
Like, I get it. I mean, like, I don't have kids. I will never have kids. But, like, if one of my, like, nieces or nephews or something, like, went missing, I would be all over the fucking country. Anyone who's even a little bit DNA test.
That's so funny, though, that he was like, you have kids that look like my kids. And he's like, yeah, well, I'm your brother-in-law. So, yeah.
Yeah, that adds up, buddy.
Genetics. In 1967, George returned to Texas with his brother-in-law. That was wrong. With his son-in-law to speak with a woman who claimed Lewis had revealed his identity to her after drinking too much, and she believed Lewis and Maurice were living in Texas. Much like every other time, though, they were not able to speak to the person who called these things in, but police were able to find the two men she was talking about, and they, like, denied being the sons. And the son-in-law said that the doubts of this denial stayed with George for the rest of his life, and that he wasn't unconvinced.
But, like, yeah, because, I mean, also, if they were kidnapped, like, they were also fucking terrified.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, like, they probably wouldn't ever admit that they were them.
Right. So they received another letter the same year, which seemed the most credible that Lewis was still alive. It was a letter addressed to Jenny from Kentucky with no return address. And inside was the photo of a young man around 30 that really resembled Lewis, who would have been in his 30s if he had survived. On the back, it said, Lewis Sodder, I love brother Frankie, little boys. I don't understand what this means, but whatever. Naturally, they hired another PI to go to Kentucky, but this guy was never heard from again. He never came back to them, and they could never find him. So, big old question mark.
Did they ever say that, like, that meant anything specific to them? Be like, oh yeah, he would say this about somebody or something like that?
There's no Frankie that I can, like, determine, like, who would be little brother Frankie, unless that, like, that's from the new family.
Oh, right. Or from the new family, right.
So,
or
from, I'm...
what they changed his name to or something. And he probably couldn't, like, say, like, oh, this is my new name, so I'm going to say this is my little brother Frankie or something like that, you know?
I don't know, man. Because, like, the picture is, like, they end up putting it on the billboard. So they added it to the end of the billboard in, like, the hopes that somebody will see it. But they take out the city because it was Central City, Kentucky. Like, that's where it was postmarked from. But they take the city part off the billboard because they don't want any harm to come to Lewis if it is him. Which I just think is so sweet. Like, they're still really this concerned.
Right. And, like, he could actually be anywhere and just have like it ended up getting dropped off in Kentucky or something.
Right. Well, they didn't put that on there, but they did actually end up having an enlarged photograph made of it that they put on their fireplace.
Aww.
Yeah, they never lost hope at like ever.
Yeah, because like I mean, even if it's not him, like I think that's gonna like be comforting in a way.
It just like broke my heart because they really just want answers. Later that year, George talked to the Charleston Gazette Mail about how frustrating it was and that they felt like they'd hit a stone wall and that they could not go any further, but he vowed he would always continue. Quote, "Time is running out for us, but we only want to know. If they did die in the fire, we want to be convinced. Otherwise, we want to know what happened to them." George died in 1969, and Jenny and all of her kids kept looking for answers for the rest of their lives, except, and this is an interesting except, John. You remember John from the beginning? John adamantly said that their family should just move on with their lives and forget about it. And
knew something.
He was the one who changed his story about having physically gone up the stairs to talk to the siblings and then just having yelled for them. And so I just think that's an interesting note as well. Because like the rest of the family, like even to like Sylvia's kids now, like they're still looking for the Sauter children. And I can see where like maybe if you really thought your siblings died, you were like, we just need to move on. Like this is painful. But it was weird.
Like if that's like your way of grieving is to just like, I don't know. It just feels icky.
Yeah, I just didn't lie anywhere. So after George died, Jenny stayed in black in mourning until her death in 1989, and she tended to the family home and memorial garden at their former house. Once she died, the family took down the weathered billboard, and the family mystery continued through the surviving children, and their own children continued to investigate. And they have come to the idea that it was the Sicilian mafia trying to extort money and that someone close knew about the planned arson and took the kids and potentially took them back to Italy. So that's kind of an interesting note too. If the kids did survive and they knew their siblings and parents survived too, they think that they had stayed away to keep the family out of harm's way.
But also, like, why would they only target specific kids and not all of them?
They took all of the kids that were young enough to like the eldest kid that they took was 14 and the youngest was 5. And so like in my thought process, all of those would be pretty easy to rehome.
But they also left the 2-3-year-old.
Who was in her mother's bedroom.
Oh.
The rest of them lived in an attic upstairs. All of those 5 children were together. The other ones were separated. And so the eldest ones all hung out. And then Sylvia slept with her mom.
That makes sense.
Okay. Sylvia would not have been there if she would have been in the attic. I fully believe that.
Oh, no, absolutely. Okay. Yep.
Okay. So if the kids, like I said, Sylvia Sauter Paxton, who was in the house, said it's her earliest memory. And she said that her and her dad often stayed up late talking about what might have happened that night. And her daughter in 2006 said that Sylvia promised her parents she would never let the story die and that she would do everything she could. And this is my 2021 update. Sylvia died in 2021 on April 21st, but her daughter is still, you know, doing everything she can as well. Modern attempts to solve the case have left people fairly convinced that the children actually did die in 1945 in the fire. George Bragg wrote that he believes John was telling the truth in his original count when he said he tried to physically awake his siblings before he fled the house. He says he could still be incorrect, quoting, "Logic tells you they probably did burn up in the fire, but you can't always go by logic."
Logic tells you the exact opposite, actually.
I know. Stacey Horn, a public radio host, did a segment about how she believes the children died in the fire, and in her blog, she noted that the fire had continued to smolder all night after the house had collapsed and that the 2 hours of searching wasn't enough. She does say, quote, "There is enough genuine weirdness about this whole thing that if someday someone learned that they did not die in the fire, I wouldn't be shocked." But this just seems like it's literally people making sure that they're never wrong about the situation. Like, they're like, I'm pretty sure that they died. But if they didn't, like, it wouldn't shock me.
Like, just stick to, tell what you think happened.
Exactly. And stick to it.
Logic tells you that they didn't fucking burn up. And even if they did, even if it burned at 2,000 degrees for 45 minutes and then it smoldered for 8 more hours, there would still be fucking bone fragments.
Well, and like, so eventually in the area, they did dig again and bone fragments were discovered. And this is like kind of funny to me. So this is why I'm going to mention it. And they were like, these are like the spinal fragments. And they're like, okay, cool. How old are they? And they're like, at the youngest, they're going to be 17 or 18. At the oldest, 20 or 23. The eldest kid who went missing was 14. And so they were like, also, these bones have never touched fire. So it turns out that the 5 feet of dirt that George had scooped up to cover, some of it was from a cemetery. And it happened to have skeletal fragments in it. And so that was discounted as being any of the kids. All right. Anyway, that's the tale of the missing Sauter children.
It makes me so angry for no reason. Because it's just like, everyone's like, oh yeah, they probably died. No, they probably were kidnapped.
Yeah, it's very weird. The house was caught on fire. So the whole story is whack. No one is telling the truth. And these poor people just want to know what happened.
And I'm sick of it.
So yeah. Absolutely. But that's all that I have for you today.
Good story. I know you were excited to do this one. You did great. Good job.
Thanks. Hopefully everybody liked it. I didn't end up mentioning, because I know Elena and Ash covered it in Morbid, about the previous boss that George had that had the insurance claim on his house and like a life insurance claim as well.
Oh, yeah.
But it was just because I couldn't find an article about it. And so I'm assuming it came from one of the many books Elena probably read, but it didn't feel right to quote or like cite or do anything about it without having any of my own information.
If you want more information, I fully trust the things that Elena finds on Morbid.
Exactly.
And if you want more, definitely go listen to that episode, because those ladies are so fucking fantastic. So true.
And so like, that's my point with it, is like, Elena already said it. And so for me to take Elena's words and then try and cut them down further, it just didn't seem fair. Right. So if you guys do want to hear that aspect, I really do think you should go listen to her case, because it's phenomenal and it does give a really interesting layer, because they also don't believe that these children burned up, because they did not. So please go check it out and let us know what you guys think. And also, so sorry that this episode came out a little bit later than we normally do. We are people.
And also, like, our recording schedule has just been messed up ever since my mental health break. So my bad, y'all. All right. I think that's all that we have for you guys today. If you would like to see pictures from this case, you can follow our Instagram.
At Under the Influence of True Crime.
You can join our Facebook group.
At Under the Influence of True Crime.
You can follow our Twitter.
At Under True Crime.
Oh, nailed it. You did it. You can send us an email.
At Under the Influence of True Crime. At gmail.com.
You can also rate, review, and subscribe.
Anywhere you listen to your podcasts.
We love hearing your thoughts and opinions. Let us know how you feel about this case.
Oh, yeah. Tell us how frustrated you are.
Yeah. And also stick around, because we're going to have some more
Spooktober.
It's going to be Spooktober. Spooktober.
You guys are not ready for M's case on Halloween.
I'm pumped.
And you know what else you can do? Join us right back here next week for some more spooky tales.
Bye.
Me so hard my headphone fell off.